Well, I should review a little bit of what we were talking about last evening. Last evening at this very hour, we were talking about certain changes that have occurred in the church, the religious life, the Christian life, over the past decade or decade and a half. And I had a kind of easy formula for talking about these changes. And I went through the. I won't do the whole thing again tonight. That wouldn't be the thing to do. But the formula that I proposed last night was that there's been a kind of distinct change from an action orientation within the church to a more contemplative one. Now that is not to say that change has occurred worldwide. Or that it's in force in every congregation or in every church, but if you look at these things sort of from a kind of detached vantage point, from a perspective of some distance, I think one perceives that there has been this kind of shift in enthusiasms or change in the interests or the attitudes of religious folk. And what I was suggesting last night is that this shift that is occurring makes the religion of the monasteries very interesting to a large number of people right now, because the monks or the people who've been living in the monasteries have cultivated this kind of contemplative life or this contemplative way of being religious, and have been doing that for centuries. And all at once, it appears that those of us who are not in monasteries and who are not even tempted to go into monasteries, not even very much interested in it up until recently, some of us have become interested in that form of religion because it appears that the monks can teach us something about the cultivation of what last night I was calling interior religion or interiority or spirituality, or if we can still use the word piety. We probably can't use the word piety anymore. And we won't be able to use the word spirituality much longer, because all those words get used so much that they kind of lose their meaning. We have to think of new ones to make our intention more precise. Now, what I wanted to do tonight then is to pick up on the on that theme of last night and do something of the same thing again, but this time rather than trying to describe this tendency from the outside, the way I did last night, the way an analyst might go about it, I wanted to say something more about the religion that occurs within the monasteries. I really can't be a reporter in that regard, because I'm not a monk. I've visited a number of these places, and I've been in them for a period of time, but not a very long period of time. But let me just stop there for a minute and mention that I think we're going to be seeing more and more literature on this subject. There's already a new book just published a week or two ago by an author whose books are on sale at this bookstore, Henry Nouwen, who teaches at Yale. And this new book is called The Genesee Diary. And Henry Nouwen, who is a professor of divinity at Yale University, spent 6 months in the Trappist Abbey in Genesee, New York. And he kept a diary of each day, I believe. And he says he has no intention of publishing this when he kept the diary. It's a good thing he said that, because if you keep a diary in order to publish it afterwards, it's not quite the same thing. It's like those of us who are in the teaching profession requiring people to write autobiographies. There's just no way to avoid having them write the autobiography for the teacher, and then it's not quite the same autobiography. But anyway, Henry Nouwen says that he has been persuaded by his friends who have seen this diary to publish the diary. And that book is now in print and is published by Doubleday, is available in bookstores throughout the country. I mention that as an example of the form of literature that we're going to see more and more now and in the future. The other kind that we're going to see more and more, and there have already been many examples of it, are autobiographical writings on the part of theologians. It seems like theologians are writing, I can't say more autobiography now than those heavy kind of dogmatic, conceptual, profound essays they've been writing all these years. But lot of people who were trying to write those kinds of essays are now turning to the autobiographical mode, partly to tell us how their minds have changed. And there'll be more and more of that as time goes on. Well, anyway, tonight then, what I wanted to do was to look, to get inside the monastery and kind of look around and to try to describe the mood or the form of spirituality or interiority which seems to occur there. And it goes without saying that all of this is based on my own interest. I'm not sure that a monk, if he were here tonight, would describe this in the way that I have. And I know my own interest in this is shaped very much by my Lutheran instincts, by the way I was trained, by what I was looking for when I went in there. So, it goes without saying that this is somewhat of a biased. I mean, I picked out the things to talk about that I was interested in, and that's, I guess that's all I can talk about, but that's the best that any of us can do. First of all, as a kind of mood setter, just a couple of stories. The first one comes from from our visit to Mount Savior Benedictine Abbey near Elmira, New York, which is, any of you been to this place, Elmira, New York? It's down central New York, but south, and very close to the Pennsylvania border. And it's one of the finest monasteries around, they say, and I guess I would agree with that. I taught at Syracuse University last fall, and on one occasion took students from an undergraduate class and some graduate students as well to the seminary for, I think, 3 nights for a kind of retreat. We were also there as a family on at least one other occasion. The story I want to tell is what happened to us when we first came into this place. And they did it very well. In some monasteries, you come in and there's no ceremony at all. They just kind of ask you who you are, and you get assigned to a room, and you kind of fend for yourself. In this place, the initiation process was set up very deliberately. And the first thing we did was to go to a prayer that was on the wall. All of us went over, and the retreat master asked us if we would pray with him. And this prayer was a prayer that we would be in the right spirit when we were there so that we could receive what the monastery had to offer to us. And we prayed it. And then following this initial prayer time, he took us into another room where he said he wanted to talk to us before we got started, even before he assigned us the rooms. And he introduced himself. This is Father Peter, the retreat master, who had been a retreat master for a number of years at Elmira. And he said that he described the history of the monastery a little bit, some of the physical features, what time meals were, and that sort of thing. And then he said he didn't feel it right to give us any advice about how we ought to act while we were there. But he said, all of you have very busy lives, and you're coming out of a very busy world. And he says that he would hope that while we were there, during that 3-night, 4-day period, we would do something while we were there which wouldn't get us anywhere. That was the way he put it. Do something while you're here that doesn't get you anywhere. Well, I picked up on that one, and even if I thought about it longer, I wouldn't have asked him what he meant, but the immediate reaction to that was, well, what in the world would that be? I mean, something that you could do that wouldn't get you anywhere. And I couldn't think of anything that I could do that I had any interest in doing that wouldn't get me somewhere. And if you do a kind of sort of profile on your interests and activities, I would guess if you're like me, you'd find that there are very few things that you do that aren't calculated to get you somewhere. I don't mean just the big success thing where everything you do is designed to move you one step further up the ladder or across space or somewhere toward a destination. But almost everything seems to be kind of purpose-oriented. To do things to get things done is one reason to do things. If you said you're going to do something, and you've got to do it. It's nice to get it done. You feel so good afterwards, maybe. But he didn't want to do anything like that. You know, nothing like that. And I had brought a bunch of books and some essays that were only kind of half written and some term papers, and I thought, surely I can read these things while I'm here. It's so quiet, the phone won't ring. Nobody else to worry about. All that free time, you don't even have to sleep very much when you're here because when you're there, because you're not running around very much, you don't get very tired, and you can take naps. And well, it blew the whole thing for me. And so then I asked him, I asked him what that would ever be. Well, he didn't know what that would ever be, but he said, "Why don't you work on that?" He said, "You think about what it would be, that wouldn't get you anywhere." And if he said that if you have a problem with that, you know, then it tells him something about what kind of person I was, and I went along with that. But anyway, to make a long story short, or longer, I ended up chopping wood for 3 or 4 hours, which was something that didn't get me anywhere. Got a few blisters. Did this out in the rain. That was the best that I could do while I was there, do something that wouldn't get me anywhere. Now, that's I tell that story because that story really bothers me. It seems that everything, so much of what we do, even our religion, is designed to get us someplace. And we were talking last night about the difference between the mood of positive disengagement and the other mood of commitment and involvement and engagement, and that kind of very, very active, the active side of the human life, and upon which religion is more dependent, it seems to me, than on the passive, kind of receptive, do something that won't get you anywhere, which really means, like that old thing, don't stand there, do something, and just turn that around, don't do something, but stand there. That's what he was saying to us. Now, I want to follow that with one other story, and I won't talk as long as I did last night, because I'd like for you to have a chance to say something. At the same time, I have to talk long enough so that you have something to say. The other story is the same kind of impressionistic account that comes from experience of this exposure of this kind. Some students and I went up to a hermitage, which is a very austere kind of monastery, up near Big Sur in south of Monterey, California. And this is a place where the monks are not even together at mealtime or any other time except for chapel. On Sundays, they gather together in the afternoons for dinner, but that's the only time during the week, except for chapter meetings, and then one day a week they take a hike, sometimes down to the ocean, oftentimes up into the hills. But most of the time, they live kind of isolated, separate, individual lives, kind of each in his own hermitage, the way Thomas Merton lived when he was doing all that writing in the Gethsemane Monastery near Louisville, Kentucky. So each of us was assigned one of these hermitages as a kind of retreat place. They're very nice little places. Again, you're entirely by yourself, enclosed. It's very, very silent. Each one of these has a little garden. And if you want to, you can tend your garden. There are some tools there for tending the garden. And you can even change the garden if you want. You can put flowers on the other side if you can be sure that they grow. There's a way to get the water in there. And you have a lot of weeds to pull. And they'll keep you busy the entire time. But and they also provide the food through a little hatchway thing in the doorway, where the food comes in a metal container of three separate dishes or parts. And it's all vegetarian food, and there's a little knock on the door after the food has been placed in these containers in the hatchway, and then you open up your door from the inside, and the food is all there, and you sit in your little hermitage and eat this food. Well, I'm digressing a little bit because I'd never done that before, what really got to me the first time I was eating that food in this room by myself was how many sounds I make when I eat food. every sound registers, like the clinking of a fork against the side, the swallowing. Swallowing is eloquent. I mean, you can do that in several different ways. Drinking, and of course it makes you think about what we do when we eat. When you're in a room by yourself eating, that's about all you can do in that room. You can be thinking while you're eating, like whistling when you're taking a shower. You're able to do a couple of things at the same time, but you're not talking to anybody, and you're not distracted by anybody. And I've become a little crazy over this stuff. I went on from there to think, you know, to worry, to think about senses and how what happens when all the senses are operating. You know, if all the senses are operating, is any one sense operating acutely? Now, one way of testing that is to go to a concert hall and listen to music and shut your eyes. It just makes a tremendous difference, I think, when you're not watching. Of course, some people do much better when they're watching. And I would guess that a lot of people don't hear concerts but see concerts. It might be better to go there than to listen to records. But to eat in a room by yourself, or you're eating but you're also hearing but you're not seeing very much, it just made all that food, you know, just that much more glorious, because you could focus on every little piece, and there was no distraction, no talking or anything else that would keep you from kind of concentrating on that if you wanted to concentrate on it. Well, anyway, these students went through this for another 3 or 4 day period, and because this was kind of rare, I think, we were invited, the students and I were invited to come and meet with the monks, the hermits, in their room back in the cloistered area of the monastery, and to tell them something about why we were there. But we had this one fellow in the group who was taking his first course in religious studies and had no background at all, whose name was Tom, the delightful guy. And he took that on. We had about 2 hours notice that we were going to come in there and talk to them. He took this on as an assignment. And he thought he ought to make a little speech. But because he didn't know an awful lot of religion and had only been in this place a day or two, I didn't know quite yet what to make of it. Oftentimes the best reactions come after you've been away for a while, after you've had a chance to sort things out. Well, he wrote this little speech. And sure enough, the abbot called on Tom to make the first presentation. And Tom started out, he said, "It's a topsy-turvy world. Things are whirling about in space." And that's as much as he has gotten written on this piece of paper. Then he thought, if he could get that much going, the rest of it would come. But it didn't come. So he did it again. You know, "It's a topsy-turvy world. Things are whirling about in space." And I thought once again we'd blown it, like the story I told last night of going into that poor Claire's convent. We had to do something else kind of quickly. And then we had this fellow, I've forgotten his name right now, Lois, you know, Curtis. Curtis, you know, stepped into the breach and gave a testimony that was like none I've ever heard. Ended up with the weeping and talking about all the things he'd gone through and how quiet it was in this place. And the words were, it was a kind of halting speech, and he lost himself in that group, and they were all, you know, they embraced him afterwards. And anyway, at the end of this time, when we were about ready to leave, the abbot called us together once again for an hour or two. We could ask him any question we wanted, and he asked us a lot of questions. I think he asked us more than we asked him. Well, Curtis then, at this point, said to the abbot, he said that, "I've never been in a place like this before." He said, I'm paraphrasing, I can't remember, I can't do it verbatim, but I feel so good being here. But he said, "I know when I get back to where I live, I won't be able to maintain the vows, sustain the vows that I made while I was here." And he said, "What shall I do?" Well, then the abbot told me he didn't know if he could advise him on that, because he said that that's why the monks are where they are, because it would be so difficult for them to live out those kinds of vows in the society which Curtis is a part. Well, that didn't satisfy Curtis, because Curtis didn't want to become a monk. So there was a little bit of discussion about this for a while. And finally, the abbot said, well, they talked about prayer for a while, and they also, I think it was, could well have been Curtis's first instruction regarding prayer, and the abbot was excellent in talking to him about how you might talk to your father or to a friend, and how you can call upon God as father and friend. And Curtis seemed to get all that, but he still wanted more in the way of strategy for maintaining the enthusiasm, the kind of devotion that he, the positive kind of devotion that he felt while he was there. And at that point, the abbot said that not what you must do or what you should do. I don't quite remember how he prefaced this, but he said, "Curtis, day by day, give formation to the life of Christ that is within you." And of course, Curtis, I don't know if Curtis knew theoretically or in terms of educational, you know, instruction, had much training on that subject. But he didn't ask any questions about that, and he appeared to be satisfied with that kind of answer. And I cite that tonight because it seems to me that that gets very close to the crux of what is going on in those places. And it isn't just devotion or prayer. It isn't simply feeling or emotions, but there's a very kind of elaborate theoretical structure which stands behind monastic religion. In other words, it's been thought through. They do things for reasons. They know what they're about. They understand the rhythms of Christian salvation in a very precise way, and the life that they've cultivated is calculated to agree with that understanding of the gospel. Now, I'm two-thirds of the way through what I wanted to present. If you're watching the clock, so I will give you time to respond here. My way of going about the study of theology, because I found it so dry any other way, was to look for the images, you know, to try to find the imagination at work in theology, not the heady philosophical. I'm not anti-intellectual at all. I mean, I'm very pro-intellectual. I don't like the blind faith way of proceeding, because I don't think it's really blind faith ever. But I think there's a place for the imagination, and the imagination probably teaches guides the intellect in matters theoretical or ideational or even conceptual. The reason I can talk that way is that I wish that we didn't have to live under the pressure of thinking that if we're reading some bit of theology that we don't understand, that it's probably because it's so profound. Yeah, I used to think that if you didn't understand this stuff, like Karl Rahner's work or anybody else's, it was just because he was so far beyond what we could grasp, so profound that we couldn't get it. Now I don't think that at all. I think that if you don't understand it, it's because you can't understand it, because it's either written poorly or not thought through consistently or systematically. And it bothers me that theologians can get by with, you know, writing the way they do, talking the way they do, just piling it. I'll be careful here. Anyway, you can turn that a little bit by looking at the imagination, and I think one way to proceed is to ask yourself, what images does the writer have in mind when the writer is writing? I approach the theology of hope that way and found one central image, that is the image of a ship on an ocean going toward a harbor to which the ship had never been before. Now, but with respect to this monastic thing, the central image, the dominant image, is the image of the desert. That's present everywhere. It's present in, because the first monks went out and lived in the desert. St. Anthony went out and lived in the desert. Many of the monasteries are in the desert. And even when they're in very, very lush places, they still refer to these places as deserts, far away from kind of civilization, from the place where things are flourishing. And so the desert imagery is, I mean, the desert context is present from the beginning of Christian monasticism up to the present time. Even Thomas Merton, who died in 1968, and who was responsible, whose influence is responsible to a tremendous extent for the new interest in monastic religion, even he could refer to the world as a desert or a wasteland. Now, so that imagery, that's the context, I think. That's how the imagination tends to look upon the world from the point of view, from the interest of monastic religion. Now, if you sort of, you know, think about that or speculate on what it would be like to see the world as a desert, a lot of things kind of come to mind. But for one thing, if you're in the desert, you're not around a lot of city lights, and the stars, like here. I mean, in a way, this isn't a desert, but it has some of the characteristics of being a desert, because it's a kind of wilderness area set apart from all the sort of regular, I mean, places where people normally traffic. So one would become very much aware of the cycles of nature. even in the desert. I mean, the stars, the rotation of the stars. And there's a definite grasp of cycles of nature in the worship life of the monks. I mean, the tremendous dependence upon hours, upon, you know, the hours of the day, the morning and the evening, light and dark, the heat of the day, the cool of the day, all the image about watchmen, you know, tell us when morning is coming, or day breaking, or dawn, or day ending. I happen to think that that the most exciting time for the monks is probably when there's transition, when night is giving way to day. Well, it could be the most exciting time for me, but I think that's probably temperamental. Or when evening is coming after the day is ending, you know, the sunrise or the sunset. So the monastic life is regulated by these kind of seasonal cycles, and there are lots of cycles that are operating in that. There's a cosmic cycle, the new year and the year that passes on, the rotation of the stars. There's always fascination in the monasteries, or there is repeatedly in the zodiac, in the new moon, the stages of the moon, the location of the sun, the intensity of the sun, the rotation of planets, the relation of one planet to another. That's always there, and there's great sensitivity to all of those things that are happening naturally. And as I think I suggested, the correlation between cosmic cycles, natural cycles, and the hours of the day, that correlation is also worked out carefully and dependent upon to a great extent in monastic life. And that's, you know, the ringing of the bells at certain hours is the sign of that of the dependence upon those kinds of cycles. Now, I haven't been at it long enough, and I don't think I will be at it long enough to be able to know how that feels. I mean, it's just in practical terms, but it makes a different kind of day for people. The day gets well. It starts very early for one thing, and I think I don't know if night people can take that or if they can ever really get onto it. I know some monks who have asked permission to wake up a little later than 4:30 or 5:30 because they just can't take it. Because their body clock's operating in this thing too, but it's very good for early risers. It's clear that it works nicely for them. But beyond that, there's something I want to say here, which is even I think more significant. The day gets cut up into a whole series of little days, not just one 8-hour day with a little bit in the morning and more hours in the evening, but a series of days of, well, sort of 2-hour intervals. That's about all they get at any one time in most of the monasteries. So they calculate their time for this 2-hour period, and they say it's very efficient that way. I don't know if it's very efficient, but it seemed that it would be because you're moving from one thing to the next. They try to get in 4 hours of manual labor per day, but in 2-hour segments with the time for prayer in between. And sometimes there's 2 hours in the morning and maybe 2 hours in the afternoon. But there's that kind of constant alternation between meditation, rest, prayer, work, round and round and round, and over a 24-hour period. It's not the way we might, most of us may start a day at 6:30 or 7 and then go through, the day's gone, then you have night. This continues on through the night. Now there's vigils at 12:30 for a half hour. Then there's the morning watch. And then there's a time for meditation. And then there's also, they do take naps once in a while, so they're able to keep up with this. And I think they sleep probably as many hours as the rest of us, but they don't do it all at one time. Now there's something in that rhythm which is significant. And I suppose if we knew more about it, we might say that if your interests or your activities are designed for these 2-hour segments, then maybe you could be more efficient in that, but you would also get a different sense about what it is you're doing, because you can't do everything in 2 hours. And if you only have the 2 hours to do it that day, you don't, as a student, say cram. I mean, you wouldn't do one thing until you get it done and then go on and do the next thing. But you do a little bit on that today, then you let it drop, and you do something, you go on and pray for a while, then you go on the next day and pick it up again. Now, this is not the right time to mention somebody is like Tom Wicker, because Tom Wicker is certainly no monk, but Tom Wicker told me one time that he used to, when he writes for the New York Times and also writes a lot of novels, that that back when he was younger and didn't know as much, he would write every day on the New York Times thing, and then he discovered that he would get out as much out of 3 days of writing as he got out of 5 days, and it would be better for him to work all day Monday on his newspaper column and shift gears and do something very different on Tuesday, poems or novels, but not in the Nation, not the same kind of thing, and then return to that on Wednesday. And shift gears and do something very different on Tuesday, poems or novels, but not in the Nation, not the same kind of thing, and then return to that on Wednesday, and then give it up. If he didn't have it by Wednesday night, of course he's got deadlines to meet, but you wouldn't think of doing that now 5 days of the week, or to do one project at a time. No, it's much better for him to do several projects simultaneously, and then when you run out of steam on one, give it up, and go on to the other one, because that'll be fresh to you, rather than trying to push things through until they're completed. Well, belabored this point, but there's something in the rhythm of the day, which is it's I think rather attractive. Now, when I say rather attractive, it's like the old colonialist who's kind of coming in there and saying, what can we pick up from these natives, and ascribe to our own religious lives to make it richer. And I don't think you can quite do that with monastic life. Simply pick up insights and apply them to your own state of affairs, but there is something rather attractive about it. There's also then, according to this wasteland or desert imagery, a tremendous sensitivity to sound, because there's so much silence in the wasteland. But they have very good ears, I'm convinced. Now, the ringing of the bells really means something. I mentioned the sounds that accompany eating. But they develop that very, very, very profoundly, I think. And the profundity of it comes in their portrayal of silence, the lack of sound, where they don't want sound. They think it's strange. There's some ironies involved in this, but they think it's strange that when people come together, they talk. You don't have to talk when you come together. Lots of other things to do. Barry Tolkien, the University of Oregon, tells me that many people who study American Indians come into these things in the evening, and you find all these Indians kind of sitting around before there's a ceremony, and they keep asking themselves, when's the ceremony going to begin? And of course it's already beginning. I mean, what they're doing there, I mean, they're relating to each other even though there are no sounds, there's not very much activity, but I suppose we think that unless we have dialogue or discussion or chit-chat or some kind of talk, there's no reality. And the monks don't think that. The monks think that there are all kinds of content in silence, some of which gets canceled out by talk. So they're very careful with talk. And there's no talk during in some places there is, but in many of these places there's no talk during meals, except that maybe somebody will read a passage from Scripture, and then they'll be listening to that. Now that you can extend that a little further, because it has to do with the training of the ear for certain kinds of sounds. And there's a 1,000-year kind of history of literature on the subject of tail bearing. And I knew nothing about this 6 months ago, but I don't know an awful lot about it now, but enough to talk about it for a minute or two. Tail bearing has to do with canceling certain sounds that shouldn't be repeated. And these sounds would be sounds of the gossip sounds, or the somebody tells something about somebody, and once you get onto this, you hear it everywhere. I mean, you see it happening everywhere. Somebody will say, "Did you hear about him?" "Oh no!" And then I didn't know that. And then you start getting the story going, and it gets bigger and bigger, and becomes more and more interesting. Like somebody whose marriage broke up, or somebody lost a job, or somebody in some kind of trouble. That just sweeps congregations. Just, you know, that's the kind of stuff you can just can't resist telling, even though you can say, "Now this is all confidential. this is just between us girls. You keep this to yourself." But the monks are trained, whether they do it or not, I don't know. But they are trained not to hear those things, not to hear certain sounds. And if they do hear certain sounds, they're trained, you know, not to repeat those sounds. Now, I referred to a subject last night that I really haven't pursued far enough, but I have a feeling that Luther, who was an Augustinian monk, who would have been kind of tremendously oriented to memory, to inner sounds, to interior sounds, to the spirit kind of speaking within, that when he used the phrase "faith comes by hearing," fides ex auditu, that it could well have been against this monastic background. And it could well have referred to the discernment of certain words that were very, very meaningful words. I mean, words of life, which were unlike all other words. And the stress then is, I mean, the stress ought to be on faith comes by hearing, but you can also say faith comes by hearing against that monastic background. And that would have to do with, It would evoke all of this imagery of the wasteland, of listening for animal sounds, for times when there are no sounds, for wind sounds, for silence, for all the things, all the sounds that silence really carries, these interior sounds, like, you know, things your mother may have told you, or sounds you make to yourself, or that in kind of interior speaking to oneself that goes on during periods of silence or meditation or contemplation. Now, I've got a lot more material on this, but I don't want to just flood this thing and just kind of give a lecture, as I guess I'm doing. The final thing I want to say is this, that the imagery of the wasteland is understood contextually. That is, the world is understood to be a wasteland by in monastic religion, if you can group it all together, call it monastic religion. And that means that it has the character of being deceptive or being illusion. Not all of it's real. It's a bit fakey. You can't take things sort of at face value. Wasteland applies in exterior terms, but I think even more significantly, it applies in interior terms. Interior terms, the heart is a wasteland, and the monks or monastic religion sees a very precise correlation between the exterior wasteland and the interior wasteland. The heart being the wasteland or the desert, it's dry, it's dried up, it's arid, it's it lacks things, and I think that one could almost argue that the most significant period of the church year in monastic life is not, well, I was going to say not Christmas, I don't want to say any knots, I'll just say what I think it is. It's Epiphany. You know, the manifestation of life, of light and life in a kind of desert place. Now, the understanding of the human heart, then, is that man is made in the image of God, but either doesn't know it. You get variation on the interpretation here. You can get a Lutheran approach or a Catholic approach, and there are modifications and qualifications in all those instances. The human heart was created in the image of God, which would mean that God resides within the human heart. But either by sin, or by lack of attention, or by both, or by willfulness, or all of these things, we don't know it, or it's not accessible to us, or there's nothing we can do about it. But that's not the final story. The final story is that, I mean, the bottom line would be that that what is there implicit or kind of undisclosed becomes manifest. And just as flowers can bloom in the desert, and just as there's all kinds of life in the desert, which is not always perceptible when you first come into the desert. You say, oh, this is just sand, and you know, it's not lush, there's nothing going on here. So too, can life, that kind of tacit life in the human heart as a wasteland, take on kind of full bloom, grow, develop, become manifested, and that's the way beyond deception and illusion. Now, they say it in a somewhat different form. They say it in the following form, that knowledge of God requires is not the right word, but goes along with knowledge of self, because the Spirit of God resides within. And in order to know the God within, one needs to come to know oneself. There's a very, very close correlation between self with a capital S and maybe self with the small s, or between the God within and the God without. But this kind of imagery lies behind that advice that the abbot at New Camaldoli near Big Sur gave to my friend Curtis, when Curtis asked him, what shall I do? And he says, day by day, give formation to the life of Christ that is within. Now, I think I've said enough to kind of characterize the mood of the temperament to, maybe I've talked a little bit too long, but if anyone wants to make a comment or say something, this would be the time.
How long at a time did you stay in an atmosphere like that?
I haven't been at it very long.
When you're in one monastery, how long would you stay? How many days, for instance?
Usually it has to be like on a weekend, and it's usually from Friday through Sunday afternoon, a couple of nights, which is not very long. And then oftentimes it's just like going in there for a Sunday, or going back to the same place over and over again.
You see this kind of experience being expressed in the lives of students, or?
Oh yeah, gee, I'm a little scared about it because we're trying to do the academic study of religion in University of California, and this is not the academic study of religion. This is religion for the personal interest in mind. And we have, in my work, we have separation of church and state to think about, not to worry about. I mean, I want to honor that. I think that's the right kind of distinction. We want to safeguard it, but I'm on both sides of that now. I do the analysis during the week, and on weekends, do this kind of thing with students. An example of this is that we're setting up a program, which is based on a pattern in the University of California in the political science area for an internship in the state capitol in Sacramento for students who want to work with assemblymen or state legislators for a quarter. Now, the University of California has been doing that for some time. I'm working on a plan now, and I think it'll be successful, to provide a kind of internship within the monasteries for selected students who will live the monastic life for an entire academic quarter, live like monks, and receive 8 units of credit for it, which is half the usual, and will be asked to write papers. It'll be an academic course. And when this possibility came about, I asked 3 students, this almost at random, just people I'd met on the sidewalk, if they'd be interested in this, and all three said they would go the next day if they could. I think this thing will be so large that I'll probably get tired of it. I mean, I think it'll wear me out because it's. I can see it running for 3 or 4 years and longer, which in student terms is a long time. And now the same man who was once to set the thing up for the state of Oregon, for the abbey at, near Lafayette, said that he can do this with the entire Trappist order in this North America. There's one in Spencer, Massachusetts, Auburn, Missouri, Snowmass, Colorado. All of these places would be receptive to having students come in, living like monks, no charge to the students, but they would have to live according to the hours, and work at least 4 hours a day. But all these places would be open to that.
Another sort of spontaneous manifestation of this in lives of people who are not connected with the monastery. You see this sort of springing up in life, or this through the influence of monastery.
No, I don't know quite. I think it focuses on monasteries, but I think that's kind of a surprise to people. What I really believe on this is that people in the churches are now ready for their pastors to become spiritual directors, spiritual guides. That may not be the right terminology, but it seems very ironic in a way that, I'll speak of myself here because I had seminary training, but I'm not ordained, but it seems that most of us who went into that line of work did it for kind of personal religious reasons. We certainly, I don't think many of us went into that to become church administrators. I doubt that. We were much more altruistic than that. And it was because we had some kind of sense of either mission or obligation to people, because we believed the gospel and thought we were carrying out its dictates, that we sought that line of work. And then at some point along the way, many, many pastors have been kind of sidetracked into all sorts of other things which become necessary to the running of congregations, and have, in a way, sort of put the first love aside. Now, I think this new thing will provoke or stimulate pastors to pay some attention to what the reason they got into it in the first place. Because I think the young people are, I'm sure of this, the young people are not looking to, you know, to authorities who have been kind of set aside as authorities by any institutions, but are looking to people who really know something. You know, who can, gurus would be one way of talking about it, and you can, we can be pejorative about guru. People of wisdom, you know, people who know the cadences of the human heart almost the way a doctor might know how a body works. Who can recognize things when certain stories are told, and I think there'll be pressure. In fact, I think that stimulates the movement to these various places. Because that becomes part of the lore that I was talking about last night. You know, the stories that are told about the monasteries include accounts of holy people. Like the students will say, "Nu Camaldoli, the abbot there, Brother Bruno, he's a holy man." Or they'll talk that way. You get good vibes when you talk to them, is the way they'll put it. And they seek out such people, and they give reports on what happened to them in the presence of these people, who really become, you know, spiritual masters. I mean, they give principle to the religious life.
I wonder if I see a paradox here with what you were talking about last night with the, called the detached, what was it again, the phrase you used?
Oh, positive disengagement.
Yeah, positive disengagement. I'm wondering whether some of the attraction of students and other people toward a monastic kind of personality might be, in fact, a hunger for somebody who is deeply committed to anything. I mean, that we live in a world which maybe in such a way hangs so loose, or about which people are so unclear about commitments which really make demands on people. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe there's an attractiveness about something like this, even though the lifestyle may not attract them, just to see anybody committed to anything to which they would be willing to give their life to that kind of discipline would be appealing.
Yeah, I don't know. Here we're talking about motivation, and I don't know how to judge it. I can judge it in a way by the reports they bring back. Now, I think the austerity of it is compelling, because it becomes a very clear alternative to the way most people are living, and that becomes attractive. Holden Village is attractive for the same reasons, in part. because you can look around the entire world and not find anything that means an awful lot, and but you find these kind of unique things and may be attracted to those. But the reports, because I'm interested in that question, I've been keeping track of what I hear from students, and I didn't start doing it early enough. But one thing I've heard recently was, well, he helped me find out who I was about somebody. And then somebody else said, he helped me put my life together, back together. I don't know how significant statements like that are, but the interest is intense and it's personal. And I know that people are willing to travel hundreds of miles if they think there's any hope in speaking to this one person who has a reputation for being able to sort out these various things that are occurring within. If there's any hope that that's going to lead to positive results.
Going there for short times is different than like choosing that to stay there and join the community permanently. What kind of turnover is going on?
That's going to be very, very interesting, because the same Father Peter at Elmira, New York, when we asked him about, you know, he always asked the questions about the physical characteristics, how many monks are here, I mean, how many of the monks who are here are here, or how many monks are in the place. There's not a great rise in the numbers of people who are joining monasteries, but it is significant. I was talking with someone here last night, that the ones that are the most austere in their religious life have become the most attractive. I think the same thing may be true in congregations. I have an idea that the ones that provide the clearest alternative to the normal ways of living in the world are attracting the numbers of people. Anyway, this Father Peter said that back in the old days, so during the Vatican II period, in the time of social political protest, he said, we had the saying around here, around this monastery, that they come and they go, but mostly they go. Now, he says, now they come and they stay. But the activity, the greatest activity occurring at the monasteries is not people coming in and joining, but all this auxiliary work, the weekend work, the retreatants. They're building retreat houses all over the place.
So that's becoming like a secondary service that they're providing, in a sense, to give other people a taste of that experience. Is that that's what
well,
I was
I think they're responding
what you're
to it. I think I don't think they programmed it that way. I think they're responding to an interest that came their way.
Oh yeah, I agree. Not that they set out to do that, but they are willing to respond and fulfill that.
That's right.
Need.
But I don't understand the one statement you said about the father who talked to this student and said, well, of course, we're here because maybe we couldn't make it out there where it's all being. How do they show them that they can live that same type of life out, that they don't have to just stay secluded?
Well, I don't know. I think there are lots of things behind your question there. In a way, they're saying you can't do it outside. You can't do it in quite the way they do it. It was in Louisville, Kentucky, that they talked about. We were talking with Brother Patrick Hart, who was a biographer for Thomas Merton, who said that all the monastery is for him is the establishment of the ideal conditions for living the Christian life. And he didn't find that very impressive, because they are dependent, he says, upon ideal conditions. He says it's much more difficult for you, who don't have ideal conditions, to live it out. And they recognize their dependence upon that. So when the father said to my friend Curtis, you may not be able to do it, he was really speaking the truth, I think, because you cannot maintain the same kind of level of intensity in the spiritual life outside the ideal conditions that you can within. I mean, the resoluteness gets modified in various ways. Now, I'm still kind of thinking about your question, because I think there's going to be back and forth traffic.
Reminds me of the old, 18th century, whatever, some of the older concept of the biggest sinners, or, you know, when there was such a crisis that was unresolvable or something in somebody's personal life, they retreated to the monastery. You know, the women especially, I'd say, you know, they go off, you know, and then there was nothing but the nunnery left for them in life. And it was, you know, because they then had to protect themselves from the rest of the world.
I'll just give one little story.
it sort of reminds the same thing.
I had a lot of doubts about the whole thing, and I still do, but I don't place these things on monasticism as a whole any longer. But I know there are some people in the monasteries who are escaping, and there are others who are not escaping, as there are in churches and everywhere else in society. But I came back. I left this place early one morning, and came back to Santa Barbara, and always feel a little bit guilty about leaving my dear wife and our children when I go off on this kind of thing by myself. So I stopped at Eric's Bakery to bring a little something home. And so that sort of kind of guy. Well, this was early, kind of early in the morning. And then I walked through one of the department stores, and I had in my mind that though all those men up there, I still couldn't decide if they were escaping from the world or kind of meeting it head on in a unique way. And then I walked to this department store, and immediately, you know, the idea gelled. I watched all these people, men and women, going up to these counters and picking up this stuff and looking at it and putting it down. And that whole shopping center was filled with people like me who were engaged in that kind of stuff. And I thought to myself, now who's escaping, really? I mean, can we say that those monks are escaping from the world because they've decided that they are dependent upon the community and upon being set apart in order to pray, in order to maintain their life with God? Or aren't we escaping by doing this kind of stuff all day long, going into department stores, picking up stuff? We would probably never accuse anyone in Robinson's department store of trying to escape from the world, because our assumption is if you're active like that, you know, living the kind of lives that most of us live, you're not escaping. But that can be just as big an escape from reality as those what those monks are doing. What the monks have on their side, the conviction that what a lot of us were doing and what are doing and what they did before is deception. We're deceiving ourselves because we take that world to be the real world. And they know that that world, at least in part, is desert and wasteland. I wish the time's gone, and I wish I'd ended this thing with a little more of a crescendo, because what I wanted to say, but I can't say it now with proper backing, is that Thomas Merton understood monasticism to be the most effective form of social protest. Not escape, but effective, kind of nonviolent social protest, which could be effective political action. Well, time is gone. Thank you.